The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's hear it for the man, the myth, the legend, our super producer, Max the Librarian Williams.
Yeah, he's a librarian of sorts. He's the keeper of the Ridiculous Archives.
Yeah.
The Library of Ridiculousness. These are things that exist
in the world. I guess we do have archives now because we've been doing this show for a minute.
We do.
Yeah, you're Noel. I'm Ben.
What is an archive if not just a repository of information, no matter how stupid?
Right. Yes. I love that idea, man. What about the library of the worst books or the library of unnecessary things?
And sure.
I also like that you're pointing out that a library is more than just a room with a bunch of books in it.
Oh, big time. Yeah. I remember growing up, one of the places that I first was exposed to kind of more artsy films was at the library. You know, they usually would have like some Criterion Collection things that you could take out from the library, or even like anime, graphic novels and stuff. I mean, like, I was always a big fan of the local library because it actually also had some kind of stuff that would probably, if your parents knew about it, be considered a little naughty.
Hey. Right? Yeah. And also, you know, as you guys know, I live very close to a library here in our fair metropolis of Atlanta. I like to hang out there. It's one of the few places in the U.S. culturally where you can hang out indoors without having to spend money. Mm-hmm. And some people love that. Some people hate that. I think we all agree that libraries are important. And here in the United States, there is a big deal library. The Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. That's what today's episode is about because to the earlier point, man, there's a lot more than books in there. And we're going to talk about some of the most ridiculous things.
I also just want to make it clear, I was not checking out like adult material from the library. I'm just talking about, you know, there's some steamy scenes in some of those Stephen King novels.
Exactly. You know? Mind reader. That's the thing. Yeah. The first time I read Stephen King's It, I was probably too young. I was a little latchkey kid just volunteering at the library. And folks are so excited when they see children reading that sometimes they don't ask what the kids are reading. That being said, I am absolutely against banning books.
Just 100%. I think we've made that clear on both of our shows. But the thing about today's episode is you think about a thing called the Library of Congress. It sounds like just the most, you know, the highest form of library in the United States of these Americas. back. I must only hold the most, you know, high-minded of wisdom-containing, you know, tomes, right, Ben?
Right. Well, yeah.
Nothing frivolous or tawdry should be contained therein.
So yes, that is perfect. That is the perfect setup. So let's go to Jeff Summers, writing for grunge.com as an introduction here. He says it is possibly the largest library in the world. Now there are contenders for that title, and the library itself holds more than 162 million, what they call assets, in 450 different languages. As we'll see, one of the oldest things in the Library of Congress is not in English. It's cuneiform. Like, they go deep.
And one thing that's important to remember is, for the most part, this stuff is stuff. This is physical media. Think of, like, the Library of Alexandria, the idea of, like, a repository of the world's, not necessarily always knowledge, but just its history, you know, because sometimes an artifact, even if it's not some sort of genius take, you know, it is in and of itself a piece of history. We're going to talk about some of those pieces that, while on the surface might seem a little silly, are actually really, really important. But first of all, let's just talk a little bit about the history of the Library of Congress, often shorthandified as the LOC.
Yeah, yeah. The LOC, right? So it's very old, at least for the states. It was created more than two centuries ago in 1800. Like the Library of Alexandria, this place is burned down more than once. Mm-hmm. We can go directly to the Library of Congress official website, and they point out that from the very early days of the conspiracy that led to the creation of this country, folks understood the importance and power of knowledge. Books and libraries were essential to the aims and the values that were set out since the U.S. started USing, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And you know, no secret, illiteracy was much more common in the early days, right, around the world. But the founding fathers all had some pretty high-end, top-notch educations.
They did. And so they were, this is education that came largely from, you know, from books to help kind of support that education. So they also realized and understood that books were very important. So in 1800, as part of an act of Congress that moved the national government from Philadelphia to Washington, John Adams added in an act of Congress that provided $5,000 for books to be used by said Congress. And this started what is now the Library of Congress. There was the first ever joint committee in Congress, a joint congressional committee that would basically provide staff and oversee the creation of this library.
Mm-hmm. And for anyone yearning for the inflation calculator, you're going to be surprised. $5,000 in 1800 was only, it would only be worth about $120,000 today.
That's a lot of books, though.
Yeah.
That's not too shabby.
Yeah, but
for a book budget.
I'm just like, the Library of Congress is such a leviathan of knowledge, right? A repository, as you said. I would think they started with a little more seed money, but nope.
Well, like any collection, you know, these things kind of tend to build over time. So that's what we started to see. And we also saw it go through several iterations. Thomas Jefferson went on to approve a legislative compromise that essentially invented a brand new job, the Librarian of Congress, and created this. It required a presidential appointment to be this librarian.
Yeah.
The Library of Congress.
The final boss of librarians.
Exactly.
There's only been 14 so far, and they all, like you said, they all have to get appointed by the president. Jefferson names the first two librarians, and each of them had also served concurrently as clerk at the House of Representatives. And
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, again, this is zero shade on librarians. But it requires a little bit of, fastidious organizational skills come with someone like a clerk or a treasurer, a parliamentarian, perhaps.
Very diplomatic. I appreciate that. Yeah. So Jefferson does this in 1802, and he returns to save the library during the War of 1812. This is where we get to shout out a returning guest, Jesselyn Shields, who writes for our alma mater, HowStuffWorks.com. She describes how the original library was in the U.S. Capitol, and it was burned down by British troops. They went through
those redcoats.
Yes, the redcoats. Very confusing for those colonists who are colorblind, but they burned down the whole place. And 3 years later, the Library of Congress purchased Thomas Jefferson's personal library.
Okay. So that's pretty cool. There were probably some redundant tomes in there from that original collection, right? Yeah, I got to wonder.
Jefferson Bible, the weirdest director's cut ever.
Oh, boy. I don't think I know about the Jefferson Bible, but we're talking works of philosophy, the classics, right? Is that we're talking maybe legal books, things like that? What would have comprised the first run at creating the stock for the Library of Congress?
So pre-Jefferson, when the library first came in, they were collecting a lot of documents in general. And you nailed it with the classics, but there's a reason the clerk is the librarian, right? They're also collecting a lot of documentation related to government affairs, and they get a bit more esoteric, one would imagine, when they get old Tommy J's collection. The Jefferson Bible, by the way, we just got to mention this. I can't believe we haven't done an episode on this. So this guy, Thomas Jefferson, famously imperfect dude, he went through the Christian Bible and he cut out almost all of the supernatural stuff, all the stuff he considered supernatural.
Okay,
which is kind of missing the point, right?
There's a lot of that in there. Yeah, that's right. Like a pretty dull read. And really quickly, this is a question that came up for me that may be coming up for some of you fair listeners. The National Archives and the Library of Congress are two different things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, good call, yes.
The library is actually part of the legislative branch of the U.S. government, and the archives is an independent agency that's part of the executive branch. And the reason I bring that up is early days of the Library of Congress, you mentioned a lot of documents and historical records and things like that. That is now more under the purview of the archives.
I see. Okay. And that's an important distinction. So we need both of them. They are not redundant. The Library of Congress, surviving 1812, they buy Thomas Jefferson's collection of books. And he had more than 6,000. He had 6,500 different works. And they continued growing, but their problems did not end there. In the early days of the library, the early decades, if we're being honest, there was not enough space for all the stuff they wanted. The fire was a clear and present danger at all times. They didn't have a staff adequate to the job. And they also eternally had funding problems. This thing popularized literacy. It popularized literature to the general public of the U.S. But it's mainly for Congress in those early days. It's mainly for when Congress members have a question, when they need to refer to something. It's their version of the internet, basically.
Yeah. So, like I said, it would have been all kinds of probably legal journals, scholarly journals and things like that of the time that would have been, an answer to a particular conundrum that might have popped up. Now it's a little more of a historical kind of site, it's an actual physical location. So it is a really interesting counterpoint to the internet. In an age where so much information, or at the very least physical versions of information, seem very throwaway, I think it's important that something like that still exists.
Agreed, 100%. Okay, so we're all familiar with the U.S. Civil War. that happens. Things are bad for a while. And the country gets through it. The economy begins to expand. Uncle Sam, as the federal government, is growing like gangbusters. The city of Washington, D.C. is also growing. This is where we introduce the Librarian of Congress from 1864 to 1897, Ainsworth Rand Spofford. Real name. Weird. So Spofford says, look, we're in a very important time right now for the country. You folks in Congress, you need to understand the LOC is a national institution. It is the National Library. And Spofford says, we need a single place, a one-stop shop for American publications. And it should also be for the people, not just for Congress. And this guy plays a huge role in centralizing copyright registrations at the Library of Congress. And this happens in 1870, so midway through his career. That's the reason you can submit a book or a work to the Library of Congress today. And we have a slight plot twist at the end. There are going to be a lot of plot twists in this episode, I suspect. But Noel, we've eaten our vegetables. You, Max, and I have given our fellow ridiculous historians the history of the library. But that's not why we're here today, is it?
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have like one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, right. Which is different than empathy, yeah. Right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
No, it's not. We're here to talk about all the weird things that are contained therein. We sort of teased that up top. So let's start with comic books, which is, again, one of the things that I was so excited to be able to discover at my own local library.
So good.
Yeah, it's awesome. The Library of Congress actually is the home of the world's largest collection of comic books, numbering in the hundreds of thousands, around 140,000 items. The Washington Post took a look at the collection and reported that in 2018, a collector by the name of Stephen A. Jeppy donated 3,000 comics out of his own personal collection, some of which were like really, really valuable and historically important comics, like Action Comics number one, which is, of course, the first appearance of Superman, and some of the original storyboards that Walt Disney Company did for the first Mickey Mouse short ever produced.
Amazing stuff, right? And we can read a lot of lists out there in the public sphere now about these weird things. Again, we shouted out Jeff Summers over at Grunge, did great work with his Hidden Secrets of the Library of Congress. You'll also see things that are not from the States. As we teased earlier, there's, for instance, the Waldseemüller world map from 1507. Not a book. Definitely a map. This guy created the first map of the globe, as far as people knew, at least Western cultures knew, in 1507. And this was new and stunning for its time because it included what they were calling the New World, the South and North American continents, based on the voyages of Amerigo Vespucci. And yes, America is named after this guy, Amerigo Vespucci, who was a real bag of badgers and probably worthy of his own episode. I don't even want to tease it more than that.
Why should you have to?
Nuts. Yeah. Just trust us. It'll be worth it. So the Library of Congress owns the only surviving copy of this map's original printing, and it was made from a woodcut on 12 different sheets of paper. And on this map, Waldseemüller calls the New World America because it's a Latinized version of Vespucci's first name. Sometimes people refer to this map as America's birth certificate.
That's pretty cool. The Waldseemüller world map. Another thing that is contained within the Library of Congress that might seem, like a small thing, but actually when looked at in the greater context of who it's kind of speaking about, it's sort of a big thing. It is a recipe from Rosa Parks, a figure seen as quite, larger than life in the history of this country in terms of, her place in pushing civil rights forward. It is, though, a recipe for peanut butter pancakes. And this is really interesting on a couple of levels, because originally peanuts, while plentiful, were kind of considered to not be a food that was eaten by, members of the higher class. It was actually a food that was consumed largely by African slave populations in the South. And it was also in an effort to kind of help black farmers improve their kind of lot in life, was offered up to them as a cash crop, to give them something other than cotton to farm, given the, fraught nature of that crop, cotton, mm-hmm. that is. And so for Rosa Parks to have a recipe for this, it was something that really connected to the black community, connected to the struggle for civil rights, and also was just like a really fun, delicious little recipe she wrote on the back of a banking envelope. It's the equivalent of like, a note written on a cocktail napkin. I mean, it really is just kind of a snapshot of Rosa Parks's kind of day-to-day life.
Yeah, and we know that people from the African continent were the first folks to introduce peanuts to North America, which is also, it's a strange thing. You travel to other countries, and people often think of peanut butter as this weird, uniquely American thing. You don't see it in a lot of grocery stores outside of this country. And you're right, Neil, you put it so beautifully. Rosa Parks is struggling financially at the time. And so she uses scrap paper to write down this peanut butter pancake recipe. And it is, it's just one of those amazing pieces of history that could have easily been forgotten were it not for places like the Library of Congress. Now, there is another place which is full of weird things. That place, famously owned by Elon Musk, is Twitter. And in 2010, before Musk gets involved, Twitter makes a deal with the Library of Congress. They say, we're going to go all the way back to the very first tweets in 2006. And each and every public tweet will be in the Library of Congress. So if you tweeted in the early days of Twitter, then you are in the Library of Congress. Congratulations. Everybody knows your weird hot takes on the people who are sitting next to you on the plane. At least if you tweeted before 2018. In 2018, the library finally says, okay, we've got enough. We don't need all the tweets. We don't need everybody's weird takes about stuff. We're going to only archive the most notable tweets.
But do you know, like, when they're saying they're archiving these tweets, is it all in like a digital version, or they're not like printing out tweets and putting them in binders?
I hope they're printing them out, and I hope they're putting them in woodcut form.
That would be incredible. That would be incredible. But like you said, essentially the volume of tweets, you know, billions, in fact, were not something that the library could keep a hold of, you know, keep on top of. So instead, they decided just to collect and archive some of the more, you know, notable tweets from notable personalities, or I guess ones perhaps that were associated with certain cultural events or historical events, you know, like the Arab Spring.
Mm-hmm.
Noel, I think you're privy to something that Ben and I have talked about earlier today. So we had our bi-weekly Slate call, and Ben at the very end of it was kind of like, oh yeah, if you have to reach out to me, guys, reach out to me through it. It sounded like he was about to go into the spiel at the end of a show, being like, you can find me on Twitter at blah, blah, blah. So I've decided that our Slate have to do all of our official communications now via Ben's Twitter page.
I love it.
So all of our official iHeart things, and this is on Twitter already. So now the Library of Congress will have to keep track of all of our official business communications that we're doing via Twitter now. Sound good to you, Ben?
Oh, of course. Yes. Additionally, you know, I think it's important for us to once again iterate that any and all complaints should go to our official complaint department at John Strickland on Twitter or Jonathan Strickland at iHeartRadio.com. Thank you for your service, Quister. So you're right, though, Noel. Even though it might sound weird that they stopped collecting tweets because there's not a physical form, unless they're printing it out, unless they're putting it on lithographs or woodcuts. But there is server space, and that server space is finite. The library was unable, by their own admission, to cope with the sheer mass of tweets. People love having their small, short, weird takes on stuff, myself included. There are billions and billions and billions of tweets. And so the library said, you know, they love organization. They said, we don't have a plan in place to organize these and make it a publicly accessible database. It's just an infinite mass of messy spaghetti. And all those tweets that they collected from 2006 to 2018, they're all just sort of thrown into servers. It's probably buried. So if you have a weird hot take that you wish you hadn't said in, you know, 08 or 09, a Reddit detective will find it before the Library of Congress does.
Yeah, exactly. So you're probably safe there.
For now.
Yeah, exactly. Moving on to things that are a little more tangible, or at least back to things that are a little more tangible, sort of in like a bit of an ick factor way as well. This is maybe not so much, but before photographs were something that was accessible to everybody, one thing that folks might do to remember somebody or to, you know, have a little keepsake was to send or, hold on to a lock of someone's hair. Also something that would be done after someone had passed away. So the Library of Congress is actually in possession of all kinds of locks of hair.
Yes.
Like an alarming amount, you know, from famous and unknown individuals alike.
Yeah. Yeah. They have a problematic amount of hair for a library. Yeah. We're talking about George Washington's hair is in there. Beethoven's got some hair in there. Ulysses S. Grant, Edna St. Vincent Millay, James Madison apparently made a really weird, intricate knot of his own hair, and he gave it to this girl he was dating. That's in there. There was another one. To the thing about anonymous hair, probably my favorite story here, is the Library of Congress possesses mystery hair that was sent to President James Garfield, and the only note was, "My compliments." Whomever wow. this was, the Garfield probably knew their identity because he kept this hair in his diary. And they got it. The library got it after he died. And speaking of presidents, as you might imagine, folks, there's a lot of presidential stuff in the library.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in exactly. to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, right. which is different than empathy, yeah. right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already yeah. see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, yeah. Let's go to our old pal, Honest Abe Lincoln. Specifically, some personal effects that were carried on his on person when he was assassinated. Things like a pair of glasses that had actually been, this is another interesting view into the life of a larger than life figure, a pair of glasses that had been repaired with a little piece of string, a pocket knife, which may well have been used to actually repair the glasses in the first place, a gold watch fob, a handkerchief and cufflinks with his monogram on them, and also a leather wallet with newspaper clippings following the events of the Civil War, and $5 in Confederate scrip.
Yeah, what a flex, right? What a flex. Abraham, you're being extra. His personal belongings were given to his son, Robert, and Robert later passed those on to his daughter. So for those of us following along at home, that would be Lincoln's granddaughter. And she eventually donates the items to the LOC in 1937. Weirdly enough, decades and decades pass. No one opens the box. In 1976, someone finally gets to it because, again, staffing has been a problem for a long time. And they say, oh, this is Abe Lincoln's stuff. So I guess we should keep it. Good thing we open the boxes before we throw them out. All right. And here's one that excites our research associate, Mr. Max Williams, to no end. There is a glass flute in the Library of Congress. Claude Lorrain was a flute maker in the early 1800s. And in 1806, Claude patents the first glass flute. Flutes at the time were not made of glass. They were made of wood or ivory. And the problem with that is, like you guys as musicians know, when humidity changes, when the temperature changes, it can throw the instrument off depending on its material. So a glass flute doesn't have those same problems. And it didn't become the norm, obviously, but it did become a really popular novelty. And It wasn't until after Claude died that metal flutes became the norm.
Yeah. And you might remember there was a big hubbub around the pop singer Lizzo playing one of these glass flutes at, I believe it was like the MTV, maybe the Grammys, I think it was. But, you know, she is actually a very accomplished flautist. And there was three of these flutes were owned by President James Madison. And Lizzo actually played it on stage in 2022, you know, as part of a partnership, I guess, with the Library of Congress. But I think there was some folks maybe on the more extreme side of politics, let's say, that kind of took issue with that and claimed that it was in some way like sullying the legacy of,
sure,
of, you know,
the, okay, the all right,
yeah, all of that. Yeah, anyway,
I gotta say there was two things that spurred on me writing this brief. One of them was this. The other one I'm gonna hold on to and I'll say it later on why I kind of thought of, like, let's do a dive into this and all. But yeah, people were very upset when that happened, and I thought it was awesome. Because it's a musical instrument. Let's use it.
How is it a hot take to play a musical instrument for the purpose, like to use a thing for the purpose it was designed? That's ridiculous. Anyway, you know what? That's still not the weirdest one. One of the weirdest things would be, brace yourself, folks, and a big thank you to all the teachers who play our show for classrooms. You're the cool teachers. Just going to give you a heads up. This one is sexually frank.
It is.
Pornography is in the Library of Congress.
Yeah. It is.
You might have heard of something called the Delta Collection. We're going to give you a heads up, folks. It is not about airplanes.
Nope, it's not. If you ask about that, you're going to be exposed to a cavalcade of historic pornography. Literary Hub writes about the Delta Collection and refers to it as one time being the largest collection of pornography and erotic material in the world. It was established to be kind of a holding space for obscene materials that were seized by federal agents, and then to serve as a database so that law enforcement could actually kind of catalog which types of literature should be considered pornography. You know, the whole I know it when I see it kind of thing. But this is during an interesting time for this type of material in the United States. It was actually kept quite secret and very rarely discussed openly. But that, you know, has since changed. It's, you know, people are, obviously, we're talking about as people are aware of this this porn stash, the U.S. government's porn stash, let's call it.
Yeah. And here's the weirdest thing about it. Okay. So why do they have this? Are they just naughty people secretly? Not really. At least most of them. This literature is quite useful because for a long time it was secret. And they didn't talk about it in public because it seems very morally problematic, right? Given the various moral panics in U.S. history. But it served as a catalog of obscenity. We always remember those famous quotes I think it was the court case about James Joyce's Ulysses, where they said, I don't have a working definition of obscene, but I know it when I see it. This catalog is a reference device that law enforcement and the courts could use for researching and defining what they considered obscene. There was one guy at the Library of Congress who was super into this. We have to introduce you very briefly in a safe for work way to a dude named Ralph Whittington. Ralph Whittington had a private collection of pornography that almost surpasses the Delta collection of the Library of Congress. This guy is super into historical depictions of naughty bits.
The beast with two backs?
Mm-hmm. The Australias, yeah, the Netherlands.
That's the one. Yeah. The Nether Realm regions. Okay. And he actually sold his collection eventually to the Museum of Sex, which is in New York City, which is also a pretty cool place if you've ever been. Mm-hmm. You want to check out some of the history of depictions of sex throughout pop culture and history. That is the place to go. Moving on, we've got a pretty robust collection of celebrity palm prints.
Because, of course, we do.
Why wouldn't we?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, why wouldn't we? You know what? While we're here.
You know, it was the palm reading. All of this stuff was very popular in the 20s and 30s. There was one of the most famous palmists in the world, a woman by the name of Nellie Simmons Meyer. She read the palms of some really notable figures throughout history: George Gershwin, Albert Einstein, Eleanor Roosevelt, and a heap of other folks, and would take these palm prints along with their autograph, you know, in the process. When she passed, she donated a portion of her collection to the Library of Congress, including the one of Amelia Earhart, which was one of the most, popular attractions there.
And we still have the analysis from this studier of palms. If you are wondering what Earhart's palm says about her, apparently it reveals her passion for flying, as well as a love of physical activity and a strong will, attention to detail, pursuit of perfection, ambitious yet rational. It's very strange, right? I know that you can submit any number of things to the Library of Congress. I feel like we do have to give a shout out here. The oldest written thing in the library is that cuneiform tablet dating from at least 2040 BCE. But you can be a part of the Library of Congress too, folks. That's the best news. That's the plot twist here. Noel, our pal Matt, and I wrote a book for one of our shows, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. And I'm going to do it, man. I'm going to send it to the Library of Congress.
I think you should.
They'll take it as a gift.
I think, yeah. I think it's a grand idea.
What else would you put in the Library of Congress? You can send music. There's a ton of music there, historically significant.
Well, what's the whole deal with copyright, you know, as it pertains to the Library of Congress? Isn't that one way of, like, copywriting something? Or like, if you have a song or a song lyric, if you send it to the Library of Congress and it's recorded, then it's officially, you know, you can prove that you copyrighted it.
You can indeed register things with the Library of Congress. And if you, like us, love validation, then this might be a fun adventure for you. We still haven't scratched the surface of all the other weird stuff in the Library of Congress, but I think we're all on the same page when we say we're grateful that this exists.
Absolutely, we are. And I'm also, you know what else I'm grateful that exists, Ben?
What's that?
You.
I thought you were going to say peanut butter pancakes.
Peanut butter pancakes are really good, though. Not going to lie.
Say Jonathan Strickland.
Oh, yeah, you son of a gun. That's so sweet.
It's basically, we're grateful for all these individuals. Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
Max Williams, our research associates, Dr. Z, and Jeff. We also want to thank Eve's Jeffcoat. Ooh, we're getting Jeff Rich here. We also, of course, want to thank Christopher Hasiotis. We want to thank all the hardworking folks at the Library of Congress, with a special shout out to the current librarian, Carla Hayden.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.